You're listening to Psych Talk.
This is Psych Talk, and I am Jose Dras Lopez. Our guest today is Dr. David Myers. He's a renowned social psychologist and a prolific writer and educator. His best-selling psychology textbooks have been translated into 12 languages and used in thousands of high schools and colleges around the world. He's also a prominent advocate for the hearing impaired. His countless writings for both academic and general audiences cover topics such as religion, intuition, and happiness. He's joined us to reveal some of the magic behind his books and to share his bird's eye view of the field of psychology, and finally, to discuss the intersections between religion and science. Dr. Myers, we have all kinds of psychologists on our show, but I am really honored to have you, such a pivotal figure in psychology, on our show.
Well, you're very kind, Jose. Thank you for welcoming me.
We've got all kinds of things on our plate. Some really cool questions about the field of psychology and about various areas of your expertise. But somehow you've got to keep up with all this. You're expected to synthesize a lot of different information in the world of psychology. So what are your favorite ways to keep up and keep informed?
First, Jose, you're absolutely right. Most of what my occupation is as a writer of psychology textbooks, is not making words march up the screen. Rather, it's vacuuming up and filtering all the available information that might make its way into a psychology textbook. And that's the pleasure of the job, too, because I say every day I learn something new. How do I do that? I do that by just getting information wherever I can. First, I subscribe to, I could say, several dozen psychology periodicals. I also scan various science news sites ranging from popular sources like Scientific American, the New York Times, and various news sources. Just anything I'm coming across that clues me. Emails, writing, researchers, and so forth. Probably the single most valuable information source for me is a little-known periodical called Current Contents in the Social Behavioral Sciences. And each week, it gives me the table of contents page of every English language psychiatry and psychology periodical in the world. And so I will turn that and look at every one of those contents pages and then initial any article that I want a reprint of. In the back, the address of the lead author is in microscopic type. And an assistant then sends a reprint card for that, and along with my email address and my regular mail address, so I get lots of both email and articles in the mail in response to my soliciting that. And then, of course, reviewers and critics, you know, suggest lots of ideas for areas that I should be covering. So it's a huge job. And so the net result is I'm about to start work on the 11th edition of my psychology text, and I've got several thousand items now filed and ready for use.
Wow. So a lot of information to sift through. It sounds like you're still somewhat of a fan of paper versus reading on screens.
I mean, I do both. I read a lot on screen, but I file information on paper, and I mark it up, and then what I do is when I work on a chapter, I pull out all the materials pertinent to that chapter, organize them according to the chapter subtopics, and then I can spread the papers out and I can look at multiple things on once, because I'm then typing on a screen, so I need my screen for creating what I'm creating. So it's a combination, but there's a lot of paper involved for me.
So it sounds like from all the different sources you mentioned, you get a flavor of lots of different ways that you could write about psychology, the more popular-oriented ways or more storytelling-oriented versus more academic or maybe even sort of dry ways of writing. What have you noticed about like the informational value of, say, like a Scientific American article versus like an obscure journal?
Sure. What the New York Times or Scientific American Mind or Scientific American or other reputable news sources for scientific information. First of all, if there's a major piece of research, often several of them will cover it. And it's interesting to see how they simplify this information and introduce it to lay audiences. Now, I can't use their words because that's their words, but seeing how various topics are covered helps inform my thinking and my writing. And so I'll often have multiple reports on a given piece of research before I start my own writing.
That's interesting. So in a sense, the New York Times and Scientific American are doing what you're going to end up doing for your textbook, which is some level of simplification.
Sure. In fact, they're doing much the same thing, because I'm a science journalist trying to responsibly simplify without oversimplifying information. And so what I'm doing for my audience is quite like what a New York Times science writer is doing for his or her audience.
Right. Well, that gets to an interesting point of the perspective of the student reading the textbook. It's interesting that you would call yourself a journalist. I think a college or high school student reading, you know, the first few pages of this tome they've bought for class would think this is the gospel of psychology almost. Like, whatever I read here is just direct findings and truth. And I'm curious how you feel about that authoritative quality to what you write.
Well, I want to write in a way that helps students feel and understand that there's a human being on the other side of what they're writing. There's a person talking to them. Second, I have a responsibility to report on my discipline accurately, fairly, impartially, but also mindful of what educated people need to know. And so that means selectively. And so that's part of the judgment calls that I'm making and that every textbook author makes. And we are flesh and blood human beings. We all have values and concerns and passions, and likely those are going to leak through even as we try to objectively report on our discipline.
Right. So you have to be selective. You're making your human voice shine through. And that gets to another quick thought I wanted to touch on, which is just, what steps do you take to try to be objective?
I think the most important check is that I know that what I write is going to be read by several thousand psychology instructors and many hundreds of thousands of students. So if I'm slanted, biased, parochial, you know, political, I'm going to get slammed. And so, first of all, I just know that. So that kind of compels as much objectivity as I can bring to it just to start with. And then secondly, once the manuscript of a new edition is ready, it's put out to academic colleagues by my publisher, and they're invited to review and critique it. And then third, I have multiple layers of editors who go through the manuscript looking for ways in which there may be something either unclear or inappropriate. And so I think we have some safeguards built in, and ultimately the marketplace itself is your safeguard, because if you become quirky or you're driving your own agenda, the book is just not going to be a successful book. There Right. is a place for opinion writing, and I've done op-ed essays. I've written trade books that really are making an argument a particular point of view. That's a different kind of writing than a textbook.
Right.
But it's a perfectly appropriate kind of writing.
Yeah, I've come across those writings too. I think we'll get into more of the opinion aspects very soon, but I would love to hear about more about those editors that help you and about other ways in which, even though you're the single author of your book, there's a whole team of people bringing the book from initial stages to the final product.
Absolutely. One author's name appears on the cover, and I'm almost a little embarrassed by that, because I'm helped by editors who... In the case of my book, I actually work with three different editors that guide my process in conversation with me. I am the author, so I am responsible for it. But of deciding how to organize the book as a whole in order to meet the needs and wishes of our audience, our instructors, and ultimately our students. And then they're helping me process the reviewer feedback, making suggestions as to ways in which the book could be improved to communicate better and more accurately and in a more up-to-date way. And then ultimately, copy editing, which is line editing in a very fine-tuned way, the actual prose that you're reading, while still trying to allow the author's voice to be the author's voice and not become the editor's voice. So it's a very intensive process. I was just talking yesterday with somebody who's going to be a future co-author with me, who's just 6 years out of graduate school. He's written, he has already authored 117 professional articles for top-tier journals. And he was saying that he's never experienced anything in the professional, writing for professional journals that's close to the level of intensive, engaged editing that we get in this textbook process. It's a huge investment on the part of the publisher.
Yeah, and ultimately, I guess the publisher is also part of the reason that the textbook gets such wide distribution, right? It's a different, it's a bigger audience than any other sort of academic writing you might do.
Absolutely. And what it really is teaching. It's teaching to a large, unseen student body. And so I think of my writing textbooks as simply an extension of the teaching that I have done here at Hope College, except it's the people I don't see, and it's the people in distant places and sometimes in other languages.
Right. Well, you mentioned it's an unseen audience. One thing that could give you some insight into your audience is to just see online reviews of your textbook. I noticed Amazon has students saying, oh, very nicely laid out. I like this a lot. Do you trawl the web for reviews, or have you ever been hurt by a bad review?
Online, like at an Amazon type place?
Yeah.
I'd say I don't pay too much attention to those. I've not really been hurt by anything, I don't think. The book is fair game, and I think the reviews have been fair and, for the most part, really quite encouraging. But the reviews that the publisher commissions are much more in-depth reviews. And unlike the Amazon reviews, which would be student reviews, these are professor reviews. And often these professors are reporting on the reactions or the understandings of a large number of students. So our review process is so much deeper and wider than what an online review process can offer that that's what we attend to.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense. What's the most memorable feedback you've gotten from through that review process and from professors?
First, way back in the beginning, like 30 years ago, when my first textbook, which was a social psychology textbook, went out for review, the publisher let me know that they'd sent the entire book manuscript to a Princeton psychologist named Edward Jones, who had previously written a much higher level competing text. And I was just, oh no, he's going to hate this. There's no way he's going to like it. Why did you send it to him? And eventually, after some weeks of waiting, the review came back, and it was just so deeply affirming. It was so kind and encouraging, and I've never been more elated over a review. But I should balance that by saying, in addition to all the glowing reviews that the publisher likes to advertise, there are also reviews, like I just picked one off at the pile here. The use of English language in this book is atrocious. Faulty grammar and syntax, imprecise meaning, incorrect terminology are abundant. When I'm reading this book, I have the feeling that it's being written by one of my undergraduate students. It's like, at times, like correcting an undergraduate term paper. And the reviewer goes on with this hostile language. By the way, that reviewer surprisingly eventually adopted the book. But one has to deal with the whole range. And the one thing I'd say to your listeners that maybe they can relate to, Jose, is that over time, you accumulate feedback that's deeply gratifying and rewarding or highly critical. And I would say most reviewers are really very kind people. I mean, they're nice people. But over time, you accumulate so much feedback that additional praise doesn't explode your head and criticism doesn't keep you awake at night. And that's sort of how it happens in life, in any realm. When you venture into a new realm, a new occupation or whatever, the initial feedback is going to either have you high or low. But as you get more and more feedback, each becomes a little iota of additional feedback, a pile, a growing mountain. It has less power to drive your emotions. So that's just a little observation.
No, that's a very interesting and insightful point, spoken like a very introspective psychologist. Let's get into some of the ideas in your textbook. I think it's interesting the way you generally lay out the first chapter. One of the things you're trying to do is sort of humble the reader or open the reader up to learning new ideas. So you talk about, for example, the hindsight bias and overconfidence, two things that might make people undervalue the psychology knowledge in the textbook. So tell us what hindsight bias and overconfidence are.
hindsight bias is the tendency to believe, after you've learned an outcome, that you could have foreseen it. You could have anticipated it. And this is probably the bane of psychology students. They read things in their book and they think, oh, well, that makes sense. I could have predicted that. But in fact, as we can easily demonstrate in class, had they been told exactly the opposite, that too would seem like obvious common sense. Are people attracted to others like themselves? Well, birds of a feather flock together, you know. My grandmother could have told you that. Or is it that people are attracted to those who are interestingly different? Well, of course, opposites attract. And so one of the things I'm trying to do by teaching about hindsight bias in the first chapter, and also the overconfidence phenomenon, which is the tendency of people to be more confident than correct in their judgments, is to pave the way for psychological science, for critical thinking. It takes a certain humility of spirit to think that there's a need not just to presume that what we think is right, but to actually check our ideas against reality. And that, at base, is what scientific inquiry is about, and that's what psychological science is about.
Right. Well, one interesting idea you're introducing here is psychology as a science where you're testing ideas, which is not actually lay people's first impression of psychology. They tend to think of more applied clinical type psychology, and they might forget that there's any way to test ideas about human nature, human behavior. So I want to transition toward talking about all the disciplines surrounding psychology. I see, for example, neuroscience getting a lot more hype. There are other areas like behavioral economics that are pursuing certain niches, like maybe more quantified or applied spin on social psychology. How do you see psychology and its sister disciplines evolving yourself?
Well, I think psychology is making great contributions, first of all, to some sister disciplines. Behavioral economics is a nice case in point. Daniel Kahneman, a psychologist, won the Nobel Prize and did us all proud in economics by applying cognitive science principles to economic decision making. And by the way, his book, Thinking Fast and Slow, a recent bestseller, is one of the great books of psychology ever written, in my judgment, and would be fabulous summer reading for any psychology student or colleague psychologist who's listening to us. On the other hand, there are other disciplines. Just as psychology contributes to economics and to sociology and to political science, there are other disciplines, namely the biological disciplines, that contribute to psychological understanding. And so contemporary neuroscience has made a great contribution, and we have all kinds of studies of recording brain waves, studies of bodily biochemistry, and especially of late, of brain scans and in attempts to understand what the brain is doing when people are having different experiences. Now, is that helpful? I mean, I think it has been insightful.
Mm-hmm.
It's not all helpful, though, and there's a critique out there. In fact, it's there's a new just published book by Sally Satel and a psychologist colleague, Scott Lilienfeld, whom I greatly respect. Entitled Brainwash, the Seductive Appeal of Mindless Neuroscience. I haven't yet read the book, but I understand perfectly the gist of it, which is that, so you show me a pretty picture of what the brain is doing when somebody's having a particular emotion, or they're using language, or they're having a sexual arousal, or whatever. Sort of like, well, so, I mean, the brain's got to be doing something, and so to know that the brain is doing something isn't really all that informative, say some of the critics of contemporary brain scanning. And in fact, one friend of mine has likened this to kind of a new phrenology. On the other hand, this can actually be very useful, and I saw a presentation recently at the Association for Psychological Science where my friend and colleague Nathan DeWall showed how different theories about a phenomenon could be effectively put to the test in this particular case, with one theory predicting that the phenomenon was an emotional phenomenon at root, and another theory predicting that it was a cognitive phenomenon. And the brain scans revealed that a brain area, the amygdala, that's involved in emotion was in fact active, and that lent credence to the emotional explanation of this particular phenomenon. So that would be an effective use of brain scans, as well as just letting us know what parts of the brain are active when people are having different sorts of experience.
Right. Well, one thing I see brain scans doing for the general public is providing some intuitive illustration of the fact that the brain is tied to our thoughts and feelings and behaviors, something that neuroscientists would all take for granted, but might be sort of a shocking thing to reflect on for someone who doesn't think about
it. So we can take for granted, but I mean, we can say everything psychological is ultimately biological because we are embodied creatures. And brain scans help make that vividly real to us.
Right.
There is some tendency, researchers have found, that if you make a claim and you show a brain scan of the brain doing something accompanying that, people are much more likely to believe whatever it is you're saying than if you don't show them a brain scan, even if the brain scan is not really added any information to the claim. So, again, neuroscience is very useful, very powerful. It's one of the big things going on in contemporary psychological science, but it needs to be critically appreciated.
Right, right. Yeah, and I'm familiar with that work on how people respond to just brain scans, even if they're irrelevant. It's an interesting reminder that maybe people are responding a little too strongly. I mean, one place where it would be particularly concerning might be in a courtroom where a brain scan is being used when it's not that relevant, right?
But exactly.
Right. Well, we got to that from just the question of comparing disciplines and how psychology ties in. So my follow-up to that is, if you have any advice for students who know they're interested in some psychology-related discipline and they're trying to choose between majors or grad school programs based on all these competing perceptions of the disciplines.
I guess I'd have two bits of advice. One, try to think more deeply than just how much you like an instructor in a particular course. Try to separate your liking for the instructor from how interested you are in the subject matter per se, apart from the instructor. And then secondly, once you narrow down a field you like to pursue for further study, you can look in the literature to see who's actively doing the sort of work that you find fascinating, find where they are, look them up on their website, maybe even correspond with them and ask them for reprints. And then once you've identified a few people at a few different universities who are doing the kind of work you'd love to be engaged in and learn more about, then those are the places to apply to.
Right. No, that's great. And I'm going to give you a more specific scenario. Let's say a student is interested in social or developmental psychology, but they feel like they're being left out. They need to be doing brain scans or working with advanced technology somehow, and are sort of wondering if they should feel content to do more behavioral measures in their work.
Right. Well, if they want to combine social psychology with neuroscience, then there are people like John Cacioppo, for example, comes prominently to mind, who are doing exactly that, and lots of other people as well. And so there's ways to bring those different things together by studying with and doing research with other scholars who are doing exactly that.
Interesting. And John Cacioppo, he does work on loneliness, right?
He also does work on loneliness, but he's a social neuroscientist and is editor co-editor of the Handbook of Neuroscience for the Behavioral Sciences.
This gives me a sort of interesting flippant thought. Do you ever have professors or researchers seemingly sort of sucking up to you because they want to end up in your writings?
I would say, first of all, people, when I ask for information, are very glad to give it. I mean, the only reason for my doing what I do is so that ultimately people can know about it. If I do it and it's published in a journal and then nobody learns about it or knows about it, then what was the point of doing it? And so to the extent that textbooks are a way of giving psychological science away to the educated public, then people are very pleased to have their work represented in the textbook. And I would have to say, sometimes disappointed when it doesn't make the cut.
Hmm.
And that's always a judgment process that every author has to make. In my case, I'm asking questions like, what does an educated person need to know? Is this important? If I teach it, can I expect reasonably that students might remember it? Or is it too esoteric, too pretzel-shaped a finding? And third, do I have a place within my structure to hang that result? I've got to have a place in the book to put it. And so to the extent that a piece of research meets all three of those criteria, it's important, it's something educated people, I think, would like to know, or it illustrates a very important concept, it's easily explained, it does so memorably, and I have a place to explain it, then it has a good chance of making it in. Many feel called and fewer chosen. I mean, there's so much research, say, that could go in, and everything that goes in has to push something out to make room for it if you're going to have a fixed-length book.
Definitely. Well, I guess you have other opportunities to include that other information. You write a social psychology textbook, for example.
Right. That's right. So if it's social psych, then I might have opportunity to use it in that text, but not in any introductory psychology text.
Right. Well, just for our listeners, I want to remind them, if they're just tuning in, that we're speaking with Dr. David Myers. He's a renowned social psychologist, and one of the many ways he's known is he's the author of the best-selling psychology textbook in high schools and colleges in the U.S. And we've been talking about some different aspects of psychology and his textbook. I'd like to keep on that strand for a moment. Dr. David Myers, do you think your book will stand the test of time with changes of in psychology that we'll see over the next three decades, over the next century?
Well, as it is right now, I would say no. And in fact, that's why we have a new edition. That's one of the two reasons why we have a new edition every 3 years of every version of the book. So I'm constantly acquiring new information. The field is changing. The field is developing. For example, epigenetics has become a major concept in psychological research in the last 3 or 4 years. And so that will be in a more significant way integrated into the new edition that I'm going to start work on within the next month. So the field is changing. All the textbooks need to change as well to reflect the changing field. And that's why I'd say no text today is going to exactly stand the test of time. Now, having said that, I have to tell you, there are some principles, in fact, a lot of principles, a lot of knowledge extends through time. On the 100th anniversary of the publication of the first significant psychology text, William James, Principles of Psychology, 1890, I read cover to cover William James. I thought, you know, I'm one of the intro to psych people of today. William James was my forerunner 100 years ago. And I have to tell you, I thought it was going to be this out-of-date, kind of laughable book. My goodness, it was terrific. It was great prose, although high-level prose. But I was amazed at how much insight he had into exactly the things we're talking about today. So a lot of survived in psychology even more than a century.
That's interesting. So there's certain principles that stay the same and certain details that change a lot.
You know, a neuron's going to be a neuron. Social influence will be around in 100 years, and explicit and implicit memory is not going to go away.
Hmm. Why don't you tell us, just for the listener's benefit, what implicit versus explicit memory is a bit?
Explicit memory is a conscious, declarable memory. Implicit memory is a more automatic, below the radar of consciousness memory. So, for example, people can, if you learn to ride a bike, for example, you'd have trouble verbalizing how it is you keep on your balance while you're riding the bike. That would be an implicit kind of learning. It's kind of an automatic learning. Whereas if you learn the names of your new classmates, that's explicit learning. And it turns out that people who suffer a brain disease or stroke that destroys their capacity to form new explicit, conscious, declarable memories can still learn new skills, but have no recollection that they've learned them. So they could, for example, learn to ride a bike, but when presented with a bike, deny that they could do so because they have no conscious memory of what they've implicitly learned.
Right, it's interesting. So implicit, in a sense, means unconscious. What do you think about those two words together?
Yeah, roughly speaking, yes. I mean, sometimes when people hear the word unconscious, they begin to think of Freud's unconscious rather than the automatic, implicit, below-the-radar mind, which is most of the mind that today's cognitive scientists are talking about.
Right, right. Well, part of the reason I ask is that I was trying out a group hypnotism session recently, and the hypnotist started off with some general information, including this tidbit. She said, "Oh, did you know your subconscious was driving your car on the way here today?" And the room sort of gasped, like, "Oh, that's interesting. I didn't think about my subconscious being involved with that." And it got me thinking about how we say subconscious or unconscious or implicit, and with slightly different shades of meaning.
And in fact, when you drive, and you know exactly, your hands know exactly how to turn the wheel to create the effect that you want, there is a kind of automatic learning there. And in fact, when you first started driving, it took great consciousness. You had to concentrate on it. You couldn't really talk to somebody at the same time as you were trying to steer the car. But over time, it does become automatic, and then you can comfortably talk. Your mind can be someplace else while your hands and feet are taking you sometimes to a place you weren't intending to go to.
I want to jump back to the changes in the field of psychology, because you said some things like implicit memory will stay the same, and we got a little primer on that. And you mentioned epigenetics as an example of something that's new and coming, which is sort of an example of biology and other scientific fields adding a lot. Do you think that's the flavor of change we'll see in the next half century, a sort of biology, neuroscience, and technological changes driving new findings?
Yeah, I'd say change comes about partly from new methodologies, new ways of asking questions. So modern brain scanning would certainly be an example of that. But we also have new ways of studying the mind, you know, of cognitive processing. We have, in social psychology, we now have access to big data, enormous data sets from worldwide archives, huge samples of people. We have new information available, we have new ways of doing research, and we have new ideas that are coming out of this research. So all of this together is what makes for the change.
Right. Big data is an interesting factor to mention. I mean, one thing that is helpful to notice looking back on history is that there'll be different movements in theoretical understanding. So we'll talk about psychoanalysis and behaviorism and humanistic psychology as movements in psychology, sort of schools of thought, and we have more cognitive approaches now. And it's interesting to think, well, I guess there might be something next, some other unifying school that hasn't appeared yet. But that's harder to predict.
Exactly. And my job as a textbook author is not to predict the future. In a sense, that's the researcher's job, to try to envision the future. I'm to report on what is, on the present and on the past.
Yeah, no, that's definitely fair. And yeah, there are some areas in a moment where I'm going to ask you to speculate. And predicting the future is definitely speculative. I think anyone who's confident about that probably shouldn't be fully trusted.
That's right. Yeah. Or else they should become a stockbroker.
Right, right. One way in which our conversation about implicit versus unconscious ties into my next thought is there's some controversy about certain types of findings. In your field of social psychology, I know John Barg wrote an opinion piece in response to a failed replication, where he had this study about what's called the Florida effect sometimes, where basically priming people or using words that suggest old age can influence them to walk more slowly, is the gist of it. And someone tried to do another version of that study and it didn't work. But there's this bigger issue, and that's causing soul searching in psychology, about even outright frauds. There are those failed replications. And then questions about whether we're only publishing false positives or just only flashy results and that aren't actually repeatable. How much do you worry about psychology's reputation and about what needs to be fixed related to all these concerns?
Well, psychology has suffered some bad publicity in the last year because of these First of all, not just failed replications, but really outright fraud in the case of Stoppel, most notably, or Diederik's Stoppel.
Right.
Two or three other people as well. And I would first of all say every scientific field can have a few lemons among its thousands and thousands of participants. The banking industry does, every profession, the medical profession does as well, has shysters among at least a few. And so it's the job of any profession, be it medicine or psychology or law, to have certain ways to weed out that. And one way we do that is by replicating research and seeing that it's reliable, fairly dependable and consistent. That's something that hasn't been real exciting research to do, just to replicate somebody else's finding, and some journals have been reluctant to publish research that's a, quote, mere replication. But I think we're now appreciating the importance of doing that. And when it comes to John Barge's research, one of his points, which I think is well made, is that, as I understand it, as I recall it, regardless of that particular study, which he thinks, by the way, is a reliable finding, the larger phenomenon of priming, that you can subtly influence people's future thinking and behavior by implanting certain ideas, has in fact been replicated in many dozens of studies. And so one study that's controversial notwithstanding, the larger phenomenon is well established. And as a textbook author, that's what I look for, not just a single instance of a surprising finding. Often, what I'll sometimes do is I'll sometimes take a report of that and I'll put it in my file system to look at again in 3 years to see if there's been replications of that that give me confidence that I should report this.
Right.
I also like meta-analyses, which are statistical digests of all the research on a given problem to let me know how reliable and how potent a phenomenon is. So, because I don't want to report just an isolated finding if it has no reliability to it.
Right, right. You mentioned this idea that in John Barge's case, there were replications of the idea of priming, even though it was different, the particulars in the experiments, the basic phenomenon was replicated. And I think that is what's been more common in the past, to just try to replicate the concept rather than the exact study.
Exactly.
So do you think that going forward, that the more of the solution is to do more of those types of replications that are sort of perpendicular, replicate some key ideas? Or do you think there really is a need to just redo experiments and forget the fact that it's
boring? The Association for Psychological Science is now launching a replication initiative. What they want to do is take some notable experiments that have really captured attention and replicate them exactly as the experimenter did them. And so where you have an experiment, like the one you mentioned of the priming people with words that connote aging and then seeing if they walk slower, that would be an example of, that's a study I've reported on. And I would like to see somebody else do exactly what he did, in fact, a number of people, and see to what extent they get the same result.
Right.
So if they don't, then I think I would take that out of my books.
Well, that's how science is supposed to work, right?
That's exactly right. And it's a winnowing process. It's self-correcting. That's science working at its best. But we have to do it.
We do. And it's interesting how they're in our human ways of carrying out science. There are certain blips, like how long does it take for the self-correction to happen? I've heard different stories about how there's some flaws or speed bumps in the process. And one is that I think researchers are protective of their ideas. And so it takes someone else or maybe a fresh crop of grad students to challenge
things. That's true. There are egos involved.
Mm-hmm.
We're human beings.
Right, right. And I guess that's something a psychologist would be well placed to say. I mean, you can find egos in all kinds of social psychology studies.
Indeed.
Well, here's another current topic and with some controversy surrounding it in psychology that's affecting its reputation. So we talked about some frauds and issues of replication that are being addressed. Like you said, there's a reproducibility project. The APA is looking into it. How about the DSM-5 and classifying mental disorders? There was an announcement from the National Institutes of Mental Health that it's not really going to use the DSM-5, the latest diagnostic manual, as a guide in its own research.
Yes. In fact, there's been a surprising amount of controversy about the new DSM-5, but it's not there primarily as a research guide. It's there to guide clinicians in making diagnoses and recommending treatment procedures, and in fact, giving definition to medical psychiatric disorders that the insurance industries will reimburse treatment of. And so that's its purpose. And even then, they've made a number of changes that are very controversial. So Asperger's disorder, for example, has been swallowed up into autism spectrum disorder. There's been, various decisions have been made, such as removing the bereavement exclusion. So that's no longer excluded from major depression. If you're grieving a recent death for a prolonged period of time, that grief is kind of indistinguishable, say the DSM authors, from depression. And so we're going to treat it like depression. Well, the critics say, you're just expanding the definition. I mean, this is going to be very good for the mental health industry and the drug industry, because you're expanding the definition of psychiatric disorder to include prolonged grief.
Right.
It's now a form of depression, and now it can be treated. People can be reimbursed for it. Drug companies can be reimbursed for drugs that treat it. That's bad. Whereas the authors of DSM respond, hey, depression is depression, whether it's a response to a divorce, a job loss, disaster, or death. Let's treat it. So that would just be an example of some of the argument that's going on. But the DSM-5 will be the kind of the diagnostic manual for psychiatry and clinical psychology.
Right, right. Well, one other change in approach in the DSM-5 is that it has a more of a continuum. It tries to avoid just black and white categories, I think is the general thought. Tell us a little more about that, about the focus more on whether you have severe or less severe cases of any symptom.
Yeah, so autism spectrum disorder would be an example of that, where you have degrees of severity rather than subtypes, or even the subtypes of schizophrenia have been discontinued in the new DSM-5.
Yeah, right, so let's types in that sense. One comment that I saw in the media in response to controversy about the DSM-5 is that this is a time to reflect on how much psychiatrists and psychologists really know about mental disorders. And since mental disorders have taken on a sort of medicalized interpretation, people, I think, are disappointed that there isn't always an obvious diagnostic biological test for disorders. How advanced do you feel psychiatry is in really understanding mental disorders?
That's right. So we have very precise tests to identify whether somebody has cancer or arthritis or any number of physical ailments. We don't have any precise blood test or other biological indicator that can tell us definitively whether somebody has post-traumatic stress disorder, for example. And so that's been the case, and it's still the case. And so the challenge for psychiatry is to offer alternative, precise, useful definitions of psychiatric disorder without over-medicalizing problems in living.
Right.
That are just part of the ups and downs that we all experience by being human beings.
Right. And yeah, I've had other guests on my show talk about children in particular and medicalizing childhood. And they were, Stuart Kaplan was one of my guests, and he was worried about too many pediatric bipolar diagnoses, for example. So
absolutely. So bipolar disorder and ADHD, are we talking, significant diseases that should be treated with drugs? Or are we talking about rambunctious boys, that are going to mature if given time?
Right. Yeah, so that, there's always going to be some controversy about that, but it's interesting to touch on it. I want to make sure I mine some of your wealth of knowledge on religion and science. Dr. David Myers, we're coming up on about 14 minutes left. So one area that you've tracked religion and science is on the effectiveness of prayer. And you've written about how there's a pretty decisive and clear lack of a God effect in well-designed studies of the effectiveness of prayer. So lay it out for us what the findings are and what they mean.
Well, first of all, let me just say, if I could, Jose, kind of what I'm trying to do in bringing science and religion into conversation and then focus in on the prayer as an example.
Sure.
What I've tried to do is, first of all, show people of faith the value of psychological science. It has some really interesting, useful things to say to the faith community. And in fact, there's a good reason for them to embrace psychological science. If you're a religious person, you believe anything, you believe two things. One, there is a God, and number two, it's not you, and it's not me. And therefore, the surest conviction you can have and I can have is that some of what we believe is an error. And thus, we need, in a spirit of humility, to check our beliefs against reality. That's not allowed by religion. That's mandated by religion. That's a faith basis for doing rigorous, free-spirited science. So that's kind of the first point I make. And then I want to compare some big ideas about human nature found in both psychological research and in religious literature. And by the way, there's some interesting connections and correspondences. But if I'm going to do that, then I have to follow my own advice, be open to where the scientific evidence leads in that spirit of humility. And occasionally, sometimes it reaffirms deep religious wisdom. So all the research on self-serving bias is kind of an affirmation, for example, of all that's been written about the deadliest of the seven deadly sins, the sin of pride, how it can goes before a fall and can lead to human disasters. Mm-hmm. That would be an example of kind of convergence between psychological and religious thinking. Or research on the relationship between attitudes and behavior corresponds very nicely to religious literatures about the interplay of faith and action. Okay, that's if you're a person of faith and a person of science, that's all cool. But what about some of the more difficult points? And one of them would be the experiments on what's called intercessory prayer, actually putting a particular kind of prayer, there are various kinds of prayer, but the particular kind of prayer that prays for parking places or healing or some specific observable outcome. Well, those prayers can be put to the test. And in fact, they have been in a number of experiments. And in 1997, they were about to be put to the test in what I call the Harvard Prayer Experiment, the biggest of all prayer experiments, funded by the Templeton Foundation, $1.4 million. Comparing people who were about, 1,800 people who were about to undergo cardiac bypass surgery and who were in one of three conditions. They either were told that they may or may not be prayed for and who weren't prayed for, or they were told they might be prayed for and they were prayed for by Carmelite nuns or people in various distant places, or they were told they would be prayed for and they were prayed for. So we have these three different conditions, so we can test the effect of prayer on the cardiac outcome, and we can test kind of a placebo effect, the effect of thinking you were prayed for. And what I did is file a statement that anybody can find on my website, which is davidmyers.org, predicting null effects of the Harvard Prayer Experiment and giving reasons why I predicted that. And in the interim, before its result became known, there were a number of other prayer experiments that came out, and they all found no effects of intercessory prayer on whatever they were measuring, cardiac outcomes, arthritis, whatever. And when the big Harvard Prayer Experiment came out, done by Herbert Benson, it had exactly the same null result. And anyway, so we have to live with that, and it seems to me that actually helps clear the decks of some of the magical thinking that can be part of religion, some of the illusory beliefs, but also is a reminder to people of faith that all of their faith doesn't promise that they'll be spared sorrow and humiliation, misfortune, sickness, death. That's what life experience presents us with. It nonetheless offers a perspective from which people can view that those events. And there's still a very deep, you know, sense in which prayer is meaningful to people who are spiritual. And so we don't have time to talk about that, but that's part of what I was writing about.
Right, right. Very fascinating stuff. Clearly you've thought deeply about it. Two quick clarifications. First, what does it mean that the prayer is intercessory? How does that distinguish it?
It means one person is praying for a distant other person. So in this experiment done by cardiologist Herbert Benson, people in distant locations like Carmelite nuns in Florida were given the names of selected people in the United States elsewhere who were about to undergo cardiac bypass surgery. Some of the people who volunteered to be in this experiment were prayed for by these Carmelite nuns and other people, and some didn't have their names given to them. Now, there's lots of ways to critique that experiment. For one thing, what kind of prayer was that? You know, and anybody who's undergoing cardiac bypass surgery probably has somebody who actually knows them and cares, you know, and is praying in a more significant way. But be that as there's just lots of reasons to have predicted a null effect in that experiment.
Right. I'm also just also small clarification point. Did the people who were getting the bypass surgery and were participating know that there is a possibility of a placebo condition, that maybe what they were being told wasn't true?
Well, there were two categories of people that were in fact the recipient of prayer on their behalf. One was a group that were told that they were going to be prayed for.
Right.
And the other was a group that didn't know whether they would be or not. In the uncertain group. And in fact, of all the people that didn't know whether they were going to be prayed for or not, half were and half weren't. Now, in fact, probably all of them were by somebody who loved them.
Right.
But, you know, so we're just looking for an additional little effect as a result of a handful of additional people. Anyway, that was the experiment.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks for walking us through those clarifications. Let's move on within this realm of science and religion. Let's talk about gay marriage for a moment, because you wrote a book piecing together some opinions about that. And this is moving a little out of psychology. It's more about Christianity, really. So why does gay marriage fit with Christianity?
Well, first of all, my calling is, as best I can, to discern and give witness to truth. And that's both a scientific and a religious calling, and it's that simple, to discern and give witness to truth. And sometimes people of faith need a word spoken to them from within their own community, which I am, because there's a mountain of research that shows us quite compellingly that sexual orientation, most clearly so for males, is a natural, enduring disposition. We also know that people have a deep need to belong. Human beings tend to flourish when connected in close, supportive relationships, including partnerships with others who care deeply about them. You put those two things together and you make a case for long-term covenant partnerships, marriage, in a word. Well, say people, what about all the Bible's prescriptions against same-sex relationships? Well, in fact, if you unpack the biblical text, there are 31,106 verses. Only 7 of them pertain to same-sex relationships. None of them pertain to long-term covenant partnerships between loving adults. And in fact, there's a lot of contemporary biblical scholarship that says, when rightly and deeply understood, the biblical literature is really supportive of partnership and of an inclusive definition of marriage. And so that's the case that I and my co-author made in a little book that was subtitled The Christian Case for Gay Marriage.
Right. Yeah, and so it's interesting how your knowledge of psychology and of science really does tie into that, into, you know, understanding the a sexual orientation and where it comes from, because I do think there might be, there is a mistaken belief in some communities that sexuality, sexual orientation is just a choice, right?
Yeah, and I think within the faith community, that view is fast receding.
Well, that's good to hear. One area that ties more directly into psychology but still related to faith is just the even though, say, there is no God effect of intercessory prayer, there are great effects on subjective well-being and on altruistic behavior from being religious. Tell us about some of the correlations there.
Well, very briefly, Jose, because I know we're about out of time, there's an association, a correlation between religious engagement and, first of all, helping behaviors. Most dramatically in the Gallup World Poll, they pulled several hundred thousand people and asked them if during the past month they had, for example, volunteered in some capacity, or if they had donated money to a charity. And for both of those questions, the answers were about 50% more likely to be yes among people for whom religion is very important, who say that religion is important in their life and who've worshipped recently. Or when it comes to religion and well-being, the data are a little mixed. If you look, if you compare religious and irreligious places, like religious countries in maybe the Middle East or Africa to irreligious countries in Scandinavia, or religious states like Georgia and Alabama to less religious states like Vermont and Oregon, you find that the less religious places are marked by higher levels of well-being. And yet, ironically, within most of these places, especially within more religious countries, actively religious people are much more likely to say they're very happy, they tend to live longer, they smoke less, they have lower crime rates, and so forth, even though the highly religious states have higher crime rates, smoking rates, and people live less long. So I call it the religious engagement paradox. Highly religious individuals and less religious places tend to be flourishing. And I think the most important information is at the individual level. At the political level, in the last presidential election, low-income states tended to vote Republican. High-income states tended to vote Democrat. So does that mean that wealth makes people a Democrat, inclines people to be Democratic? No, if you look across individuals, greater wealth is associated with more Republican voting. And I think that's where the real story is told.
Right, right. So, it's an interesting demonstration of thinking critically and of not just looking for one really simplified trend, looking at groups versus individuals.
It's a really interesting paradoxical findings, but bottom line is, one respects science and the faith basis for doing science in a spirit of humility to listen to the data.
Right. And it's very interesting to hear you as a voice for that. I mean, you're very uniquely positioned in both of these worlds of faith and science. So it's been great hearing your perspective on that and on psychology and your textbook. As you can tell, I'm wrapping up because we are out of time. But it's been such a pleasure. I'm sure you resent this notion, but talking to you really is like talking to this really friendly textbook that's been incarnated.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your having me, and it's been a pleasure talking with you, Jose.
Thanks so much. For our listeners, we've been talking with Dr. David Myers, renowned social psychologist, author of many popular books such as The Pursuit of Happiness, What God Has Joined Together, A Friendly Letter to Skeptics and Atheists. And what we focused on today was his best-selling psychology textbooks. This is Psych Talk on WCOM. Thanks so much for listening. Take care.